So I remember, I think this was in 2004 in San Francisco. I went to the Embarcadero Cinema downtown, which was a new theater that shows first-run movies. And I bought a ticket, which was only $2, because the movie I was buying a ticket for was 17 minutes long. It was Michelangelo Antonioni's short film called Michelangelo Eye to Eye. And it was maybe his last movie, or one of his last movies. It was a short. And in the movie, Antonioni himself walks into a church, sees a famous statue of Moses carved by Michelangelo, studies it for 16 minutes or so, and then walks back out. And that's the whole thing. But I have thought so much about this, I closely studied it, because I think of how I saw it. And I didn't really realize it until I left the theater that I don't think I've ever seen a short like this. So the deal was, I subscribed to this email list that told me what kinds of things were showing at this landmark theater every week. And I would just sort of skim it and delete it. And I was skimming it this week and I saw a short by Antonioni, only two showings, one on Saturday morning, one on Sunday morning. I thought, well, that's weird. It is weird.
It is weird.
I mean, we often see shorts at like a festival where you see them in a group of, a dozen or so of them, and it's an hour and a half of shorts. Or you might see one tacked onto the beginning of a movie. Or you might see them at home, pull them up on YouTube or on video or something. But I can't remember ever having gone into a theater, sat down, no trailers or ads. The short starts, it's 35 millimeter, it's 17 minutes. And when it's done, the lights come up and you walk out into the day and you have your lunch. And I think because of that, it gave me just a chance to think only about that short and ruminate on the details of that short because it sounds really simple. And yet, years before this, maybe 10, when was it? At least 10 years before this, maybe 20, Antonioni had a stroke and was not able to walk or talk after that point, and so didn't walk into anywhere and touch anything. And although he made movies after that, it's sort of understood that they were in collaboration with his wife, and it's really unclear what that process was. And they're very different after that point. But I think this particular short is really beautiful because of how it depicts him. It's clearly special effects. It doesn't look like it, but he is not able to walk into a church the way we see him walk in this movie. And it's very dark, and there are a few shafts of light. And the camera pans over parts of the statue, and it uses a deep focus to sort of take you through layers of the statue. It's very quiet. He reaches up and touches its toes. It's a very large, it's like it's larger than life sort of statue, but he can reach up and touch its feet. And you can hear the brush of his very wrinkled hands on this stone. You can hear the tap of his ring. And as it sort of lingers on the feet, you wonder if he's contemplating his own inability to walk. The contrast between his wrinkled skin and sunken cheeks with the sort of permanence of this stone, you think is he considering his life? Is he considering his legacy? His name matches the person who made this. Is he considering his own work? Would it live as long as this did? All these things that if I'd seen this with, a collection of 10 other shorts, I might have thought of a few of them, but I loved getting to see this. And I still have no explanation for why this was shown this way. And I know he did this thing with Steven Soderbergh as a part of this Eros project that they did. And so I don't know if there was some bit, I really have no explanation for why they did this, but I love the sort of meditation, the poetic meditation on permanence and legacy and life that this film represents. And the way he walks out of the theater after, I was thinking it's kind of strangely a mirror of how I saw the film itself. I walked in, I watched and studied for 17 minutes, and then I walked out into the light. And in some ways, maybe it was similar for him, who maybe he didn't even walk into this church. Maybe he's never been to this place. It's all the magic of cinema, in the same way that it was the magic of cinema for me to witness him doing it, And all you mentioned recently when we were talking about Lady Bird and the Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, about the context for having seen a film. And I didn't think of this until later, that the context for me really shapes what I think of the movie, as it does for everything we see. But I'm just really glad that I got to see it the way I did, because it holds a special place for me in his sort of in the pantheon of Antonioni films, who I don't know what he'll be remembered for, you know, La Ventura and Les Clis and Red Desert. And I hope that maybe Michelangelo Eye to Eye would be one of those as a sort of beautiful little end to his career.
Oh, that's nice, Rob. And the way you describe it is so lovely, but it also makes me realize that part of your appreciation for the film is that you knew the backstory of Antonioni. You sort of knew what he had sort of been through and the larger context. And it just sort of reminds me that when we come to movies, you know, sometimes we come with a lot of knowledge. Sometimes we don't come with much knowledge at all. And that can affect our viewing, of course. And it's not a good or bad thing. It just is the way it is.
And neither is right or wrong, necessarily.
That's right. But there's something nice when our sort of our knowledge of our greater knowledge can inform a viewing like that and make it a much richer experience. Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good. My throat is cleared up, so I'm back to my regular register. How are you?
I'm good. Getting ready to head out of town here for the holidays, which is always exciting. But I'm also excited because we get a chance to record another podcast here. Both of us saw Frederick Wiseman's new documentary, Ex Libris, earlier this fall. And we've talked about it a couple times, just sort of off mic. But it felt like the sort of movie that was worth a larger discussion in a podcast. For people who don't know, Frederick Wiseman is a great documentary filmmaker. He's been making movies since 1967 with one of his probably most famous films, Titicut Follies, which sort of exposed sort of the horrors of the mental institutions of the 60s. But he's been making these movies almost every year, every other year, that focus on institutions or different parts of society. Like, he had one that he called Public Housing. One was called Domestic Violence. One was just a documentary about Belfast, Maine. And what's interesting about Wiseman, that's very different than I think most documentary filmmakers that people tend to view, is he uses no voiceover, no talking heads. It's just sort of direct cinema or cinema verite, where he just, you know, he films people talking or people doing things, and then in the editing room puts all that together and sort of creates a portrait of an organization or a place. It's not to say that he doesn't have a viewpoint, and I think we'll talk about this with Ex Libris, but the viewpoint is not necessarily obvious or in your face. I think he's made like almost 45 movies. I don't know how many of you've seen. I was counting it today. I've actually seen 10, which I don't know, feels pretty good to me.
Especially since they're fairly long. I mean, it's a real investment to sit down and watch one of his movies. They're fly on the wall sort of things and they're made contemporaneously. So you mentioned Titicut Follies. It was made in 1967 about, you know, a present day mental institution. And all of them are that way. They're sort of like, you know, one was about the University of California at Berkeley. This was a recent one, you know, just a couple of years ago at Berkeley, it's called, where he just, you know, sat down and saw various things going on at this university. And then what's really cool about them is then how he edits that footage. And the full title of Ex Libris, the one we're talking about now, is Ex Libris New York Public Library. And it's all about the library system in New York.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think most people, if they know anything about the New York Public Library, it's the main branch on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. And certainly Wiseman has footage of that, and it's a beautiful building. But a lot of what he's doing in this film is actually focusing on the library system as a whole. And so he goes to different branches around the five boroughs, and he sits in on meetings of various library administrators, and tries to provide, again, a kind of a composite, a portrait of the whole system and what it means to the city of New York. As you said, his movies tend to be quite long. This one's comes in at a relatively brief 3 hours and 15 minutes. I think Berkeley was four full hours.
Over four, yeah.
And so,
did you see that one?
I did see that one, which I didn't like quite as much as Ex Libris, and maybe we can sort of get into that. But what did you think of Ex Libris?
Oh, I thought it was just great. I mean, one thing I love about his movies is you spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, at a spot, you know. But he doesn't give you necessarily very much context, sometimes no context for where you are. You just have to sit and watch and figure it out. Okay, where are we? Mm-hmm. We're watching someone talk. Okay, she's talking to a group of people. What's this about? Okay. Mm-hmm. And you sit there and you sort of hear it. And after a few minutes, you realize, okay, it's a seminar. It's about this. These people have come to the library to hear about this topic and hear this speaker talk. And you get a few minutes of that. And that's actually in this movie, it's really interesting because of the breadth of things that happen at the New York Library. Yeah, I mean,
that's right.
The number of things, it's so far beyond checking out books. I mean, it's just, it's woven into the fabric of the city. Mm. It's pivotal to people's lives. And one of my favorite recurring images throughout the movie was just the picture of someone's face watching and absorbing and taking in whatever is being spoken or sung or delivered. The people just sponges thirsting for, you know, knowledge that's going to just satisfy some curiosity they may have, or that's going to help them in work, or that's going to be some important thing that they need to get through life in the city. And so I loved, first of all, seeing how each of those little mysteries unfolds. You know, here we are in this little section, what's going to happen. Mm. But then trying to figure out how each of those pieces fits together, and some of them recur, and we come back to groups of people we've seen before, and we think, aha, I see. I recognize these people this time, and now they're in a different situation. What's happening now? And so it's always constantly keeping you on your toes and gradually filling in a picture of the New York Public Library, but also a bigger picture of the city and the country.
I like that you point out that so much of what we're seeing sometimes is the audience and various events, various talks that are being given. One of the things that I particularly liked about that was you really see the diversity of New York City and just how many different kinds of people there are that are engaging with the library system. You know, old and young, all different kinds of races,
all different languages.
Yes, that's right, and socioeconomic status and the like. One of my favorite things about the movie that I kind of started noticing maybe a third the way through was often in these situations where you're at kind of maybe some sort of event where there's a speaker or there's an interviewer and there's an audience, is the scene begins with the audience. So you have a chance to say, oh, who's at this event? What kind of people are here? And then you're hearing the interviewer or you're hearing the speaker sort of off screen. And one of the things I found fascinating was you're listening to them for maybe, I don't know, 5-10 seconds before you actually see them. Then Wiseman will cut to the person who's talking. And I was impressed by how often I had an image of what that person would be and how rarely who they were fit with the image that I had in my mind just from hearing their voice. And it happened so often that it felt intentional on Wiseman's part. I mean, part of it is, you know, just assumptions that I might be making. But it seemed intentional on his part to sort of say, there's much more to this city than you might think. There's much more to the sort of people who write books or who talk about books or who talk about, you know, other events that are going on. And I really liked that part of the movie because it kept me on my toes in ways that I didn't expect going in. And I found that a really kind of fun thing to just focus on as the movie went along.
Yeah. And the diversity of the people is sort of reflected in the diversity of the places. Like,
absolutely.
You might imagine that the New York Public Library, it's this big stone building with columns outside or something. And you do see that. But you also see this little neighborhood branch. You see people meeting in one little room around a kid's table. Or you see, at one point we saw the place where they process all of these returned books and they're going down conveyor belts. And
fascinating.
It was. I had actually never thought of that there are so many books in the New York Public Library that they, you know, it's like being at JFK or something. It's an airport, but they're books instead of luggage going around.
In a strange sort of way, that scene could have gone on for 10 more minutes and I wouldn't have minded. It was just sort of fascinating just to see how it works and how the books get moved around. I thought that was amazing.
And one of the recurring things that I think is interesting to talk about is we see some of the people who run the library, the managers of the whole thing. So they're, you know, city officials who have this really gargantuan task of keeping this thing afloat. And we're told several times that it's a public-private partnership, that it's called the public library, but it actually gets a lot of its funding from private sources. And this tug between what the city needs and what the people need and what funding will allow is sort of constant and pervasive, and it keeps popping up in this film as we see the struggle of figuring out what to fund and where those funds should come from. And sometimes it's really jarring when you see, I think it's a board of trustees or something, but it's a very, it's a sort of ritzy event where people come with tuxedos and their their red poetry as they sit at a fancy dinner. But it's because this library does these sorts of things in order to keep this flow of money coming in.
That's
but there are constant sort of battles of figuring out how best to spend that and what's right and what's, you know, what's good for the city and what's fair.
And it's also interesting when the administrators will talk about how they have to almost massage egos of politicians. You know, it's like, oh, so this person's important, so we've got to make sure they're on board. Or this person is someone's, you know, assistant. We need to make sure that they're in the loop. And so it's not just dealing with kind of, you know, the private money, that it's also dealing with, you know, sort of public figures and what they may or may not be able to do for the library. But all of them have to be engaged with in ways that will be productive long term. And it's interesting to see the administrators talk about those kinds of relationships.
It's a real balancing act. I mean, one of the interesting sequences when they were talking about ebooks, you know, which is probably a big, you'd think, a big topic for a library, as people have shifted to reading things on a Kindle or an iPad or something instead of paper. Well, to the library, which is just sort of providing knowledge and information to people, this is just another avenue, and it's something the library needs to do. And yet, that opens up challenges that they didn't have to deal with before, because instead of buying a physical book and putting it on a shelf and deciding, you know, how many books you have room for and all of that sort of thing, now it's you're buying a license. So you have room for everything, but what do you pay for? Do you let the new bestsellers could easily suck up all of the funds, you know, if you bought licenses for those, which lots of people want to read. But then you also need this, what they call the long tail, the graph of all the other things that people need that stretches off into infinity. And, you know, how can you negotiate licenses for those too? And so it's a whole new area that libraries like this are having to deal with. But it's all in service of the same things that they've been dealing with forever. It's just a whole new wrinkle, and it's always a juggling act.
Yeah, for me, that particular conversation was interesting. I have to admit that I found myself getting a little bored with some of the meetings. Not that they're interesting or not interesting at first, because they are, but we see a lot of them. I mean, it feels like there's at least 8 or 9 in the movie, and they're, and, you know, Wiseman's not just giving us a few minutes. He's often giving us, you know, 8 to 10 minute snippets of these meetings. And I found myself by the 5th or 6th one thinking, okay, I've heard this before. My guess is that you feel differently. Did you not find yourself finding that tedious?
I felt some tedium. It was coming to me because I felt if I were in that meeting, I'd be really bored.
Yes.
But since I wasn't, since I knew I just had this moment to watch it, I felt like it kept my wheels turning. Not that I cared about necessarily the details, but I did start thinking about what is the right moral way to run this. I mean, I sort of, it's very easy sometimes to watch a movie like this or At Berkeley, which is about the people running the University of California, Berkeley, and dealing with protests and controversies and things like that. It's very easy to pick a side in this moment and say, that guy, come on, spend the money on what's important, you know? But when you spend enough time, you do realize that it's difficult. And I think that Wiseman, as you said, he doesn't say anything with his voice through any of these movies or even text on the screen. He just lets you watch. But you always get the feeling that he both empathizes with the people, meaning the broad population of the universe, but also recognizes the complexity here and is not afraid to show us the wrestling with that. You know, it'd be easy to cut that out or simplify it. And by letting it play out, even if it's a little dull sometimes, the details of how they're going to fund this or that, or that it's just a management meeting or whatever, knowing that that goes on and that that is somebody's job, that's a whole group of people's job, and that it's hard, I think it's an important piece that we need to see. And it makes for a truer picture.
Yeah, I won't deny that. I just found myself, it felt like I had gotten what I needed to know and sort of thought through those issues in the first 4 or 5 meetings. Whereas I'm not sure the last 3 or 4 added demonstrably to my understanding or to my thought process.
Yeah. Maybe so. I mean, one of the things I find myself doing when I'm watching any Wiseman documentary is asking, why am I seeing this? And sometimes it's not that every moment has some all-important purpose, but I think he put it here for a reason. I think it is this length for a reason. Sure. I think that everything was there for some, did have some purpose, whether large or small. Like even we see several celebrity appearances. You know, there are people mm-hmm. like Elvis Costello giving a talk at the public library and talking about
Richard Dawkins and
famous people like that. And I actually was thinking about this during the Elvis Costello talk, because he was talking about a song that he wrote, "Tramp the Dirt Down," about Margaret Thatcher. And at first, as I'm watching this play out, I'm thinking, okay, this is just another sampling as we're getting of the kinds of things that happen at the public library. Here's a famous songwriter talking about his craft, and we see lots of artists talking about the things they do, and we see people watching and interested in that. But then as he talked, he was talking about why he felt like it was okay for him to write a song that was brutally critical of Margaret Thatcher, but then also why it was okay for him to continue singing it after she died, and that he had been criticized for this because, how can you speak so ill of the dead, you know? And his defense was, this is a democracy and I can say what I like. You know, there was a very clear First Amendment thing at the very end. And then Wiseman cuts away at the end of that. And I felt like, okay, here's a reason that we were watching this. Besides giving us flavor of the kind of thing that happens at the public library, this is an important thing, too, that happens at the public library, is that you can say things and you can talk about things that are hard to talk about. And here's an example of a famous person doing that. But there are lots of other examples of talking about any topic that you're maybe curious about. You can find something about it here. And so I felt myself asking the same kinds of things in those finance things, is why are we watching this? And I think that it is an important part of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think you're right. There's this sense that Wiseman is deeply invested in certain institutions of a democracy. A recent movie of his that I really love quite a bit more than Ex Libris is In Jackson Heights, which came out a couple of years ago. Yeah. And, you know, Wiseman, it's another 3+ hour movie where he's in this neighborhood in Queens. And he just spends a lot of time in with different organizations, like organizations that are trying to help new immigrants, organizations that are advocating for gay and transgendered people, a Jewish community center, and so forth and so on. And, you know, his clear admiration for these different people who are advocating for different kinds of people is inspiring. And so for me, I actually like sort of that approach a little bit better in Jackson Heights, because it feels a little bit more, I don't know, grounded to me. Whereas for Ex Libris, for all of its strengths, and it has many, I got a little bit tired of the meetings and I got a little bit tired of the celebrities, because it feels, I saw this movie with Rick Perlstein. Rick is an historian, a friend of mine, and
the author of Nixon Land and other great books.
And Rick is a great guy, and Rick has actually done a lot of research at the New York Public Library, so he has a kind of a personal investment. And he came out of this movie and he liked the movie, but the very first thing he said is, why do we have to have so many, you know, shots of what did he call them? Basically all the parties, all the, you know, the glittering fundraisers and that sort of thing.
Oh, there's Calvin Trillin and there's, yeah.
And so for him, that was sort of a betrayal of what he sees the New York Public Library as. And while I don't go that far, I think there's something, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates is as a great moment in this movie. And I wouldn't want to get rid of that. I do like movies like In Jackson Heights a little bit better, just because there's a better sense of what the community really is. Whereas in Ex Libris, it feels a little bit more fragmented to me. But maybe that's just mine.
Maybe so. I mean, in Jackson Heights, it's where the people live. But it's still kind of interesting that he seems to love to capture these people in transition. Like, if I remember right, in that one, there is the Jewish Community Center. But a lot of people are like, this is a great facility. And there aren't as many Jewish people who live in this neighborhood as there used to be. Can we use this for other things? Can we, you know, what's the negotiation that happens there to make this useful to the community, but still maintain its sort of identity? And you see that with the ebooks, and you see that with in Ex Libris, the people who need internet access and don't have it any other way, but the library can provide it to them with these.
Right.
You know, there's this registration system that we see where they're getting these little these wireless things they can attach to their computer to get internet access, which is really cool and it's something you don't necessarily think of as something that the library provides. And I think I see your point about how maybe there are pieces of this that are like, yeah, does this provide a broader picture of the community, or was it included because he needed access to make the movie? Like, certainly someone gave him permission to put these cameras in all these places, and maybe there
That's
were
right.
I don't know if they gave, I have no idea if he accepts any stipulations on what he can do with that footage. My guess is maybe he doesn't, but anyway, you entertain those ideas when you're watching some of that, I think. Yeah. But also, I think if this were the only documentary this guy had ever made, maybe I could see that more than this is the 40th or whatever, and this is one slice of a broad, this is a lifelong project of documenting people and the institutions that they've created and that they struggle to maintain and that are constantly evolving. And it's fascinating every time. I assume you saw this in a theater, right?
Because
it's not even available any other way. Yeah. His movies, I don't know if everybody has this opportunity to see them in a theater, but it's really the way to do it, because you can see these at home, and if that's the only way to see them, you've got to do it. But if you have the chance to see it in a theater, it's really it's helpful, at least to me, because you sit there, you don't get to pause, you don't get to you're immersed in it for the full 3 hours, and you're
that's
at the
right.
pace that he has decided you're going to watch it at, and you watch it in this order, and yes, you're going to sit through this 5 minutes of the meeting, you'll get something else after this, and that'll be interesting, but think about what you're seeing here first and piece it into the whole. And I think that just going along for that ride really helps, and they're long enough that it's hard for me to see them any other way.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's interesting. You talked about the length of this film, and it is a long film, but I never really got in this, felt like I was, like it was too long. You know, I mentioned that I could do without maybe some of the meetings, but it's not like I was bored. It's not like I felt like, you know, I had to look at my watch like, oh, are we to hour three yet? But it does remind me, this discussion of length, of maybe my favorite Wiseman film, which is an earlier film from 1975 called Welfare. In which he sort of, most of the film takes place in one welfare office in New York City. And one of the things that's fascinating about this movie is he's trying to show you just the difficulty of bureaucracy for everyone involved, for the people who are trying to apply for welfare, for the people who are trying to resolve some issue with their welfare, with the workers, with the administrators, with people above them. And the movie intentionally feels long at times because it wants you to experience that sense of waiting.
Yeah.
And that sense of waiting, of not knowing what's going to happen and is this going to be resolved. And the experience of watching it almost becomes like an experience of trying to get something done at one of those offices. And for me, that sort of marriage of form and content is one of my favorite things about Wiseman. And while Ex Libris isn't, you know, it's not trying to be long, but there's a sense in which it's trying to be as complete as it can be, I think. And so the length is trying to give you the full sense of the New York Public Library system. And I think on a whole, it does that really well and really beautifully.
Yeah, I think as I'm sort of thinking about the movies of his that I've seen, the ones that work, maybe the only one that sort of stands out to me as one that didn't quite work, stands out for other reasons, and that's Crazy Horse. Did you see that one?
I have not seen that.
It's about the sort of nightclub in Paris. And as I say this, I realize it's really different. It's not, it's an institution of sorts, but it's not like woven into the fabric of the city, and it's not an American city. So maybe it's, I think of the way Kiarostami made that Africa documentary and somehow brought his aesthetic to this new situation, and it was brilliant. Where in this case, Crazy Horse, I feel like it didn't quite reveal anything interesting to me. It was one of the few missteps I felt of his. It was maybe interesting to see how something like that is put together, but it wasn't. It didn't feel of a piece of this whole project like most of his do. But I agree with you that the length is important. It's just, it's not waste. Like, nothing is wasted.
Right.
They all
right.
look long on paper. And yet when I think of what I might cut out here, it's like, well, I you could cut something out, but you would have not quite as complete a picture of the public
right.
library or any of these institutions.
Yeah.
And it's, I loved that we got to hear people answering the phones. People call the library and ask for information about things. And
the craziest information.
And no one says, I don't know, why don't you go Google that or something? You know, no, they're like, all right, let me see what we can find, what we normally do. You know, they give it their best effort. It's really cool. The librarians are so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could have watched, again, another 10 or 15 minutes of just those phone calls.
Yeah.
Those were fascinating. And it was just, it was fascinating to see both what people call about, but also how the librarians respond.
Yeah.
And, you know, another thing that I could have had, would have gone on much longer is, we were talking before about aspects of the library system you don't really think about. And one I didn't think about until I saw this movie was all the job training that they do, or all the, like, you know, computer training skills. And so they have different sort of workshops or different classes that people come in. And again, you see these people in the library system who are, you know, just doing their best to help people who may not have a whole lot of skills, but, you know, want to improve their lives. And I found those scenes particularly compelling. And again, there's, they go on for a while, but that didn't, you know, that didn't bother me at all. It was just fascinating to sort of watch how it all played out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have to tell a little of the story of how I ended up seeing this movie. Of course I wanted to see it, but I happened to be working in the Bay Area. And it was a work trip. And so I was in Palo Alto for a while, and I thought, I'm going to try to get up to San Francisco. Actually, I'm going to try to get up to Berkeley, to the Pacific Film Archive, where I used to hang out a lot, and try to see something. They're showing a Chantal Ackerman series. I'm going to try to catch a movie up there. And I got on the Caltrain. I'm headed up north. And this is, I've done this a million times, but I'm a newbie now. You know, I haven't lived in the Bay Area for almost for a decade. So I miscalculated, and I'm riding the train up, but I'm looking at my watch thinking, there is no way that I can get to my hotel, drop off my bag, and get to Berkeley in time for this movie. Well, what if I just take my bag? Like, what if I go straight to the PFA? No, I still can't do it. Well, there's another theater, the Roxy, which is really close to the BART train station downtown in the Mission. And so I quickly pulled up their schedule. Oh, they're showing Ex Libris. And so I thought, great, I will go see the Wiseman documentary. It's perfect. And so, and I have just enough time to get a burrito before. I got off Caltrain, switched to BART, got off BART in the Mission, and I went to my favorite taqueria, which is still there and has not changed. I'm shocked, as San Francisco has changed so much, but that was still there. I had a burrito. I went to the Roxy and got my ticket, and I sat down, and I'm ready to watch the movie. I have my bag with me. Of course, I didn't have time to drop it off. And as I sat down, I heard someone behind me say, "Rob?" And I turned around, and it's Brian Dar, old cinephile friend from San Francisco. What? How perfect to drop in at a theater. This is like the old days, and run into the people I used to always run into at movies.
Yeah.
But also Brian, of course, worked as a librarian for many years, still is for many years in San Francisco. And so it was great comparing notes with him afterward.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah. So it was just like, it was a great San Francisco experience.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
And Brian was a early supporter of this podcast way back.
One of the few guest appearances on this podcast, if I recall, talking about Sundance. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. It's well, I'll sort of add one last quip about seeing this with Rick. Rick Perlstein, as I mentioned, did a lot of research on his early books in the New York Public Library, and especially at the main branch. And he had told me beforehand that a few years ago there was a huge controversy over whether they were going to take some of the stacks in the main library or the main branch and take them out and sort of move them like to New Jersey and replace that floor space with like computers so that people could use, you know, the internet and so forth. And Rick, being a researcher and having spent so much time there and having access to books sort of almost instantly, found that to be a horribly misguided notion and a sort of betrayal of what the New York Public Library was supposed to be. And so the fact that the movie didn't deal with that situation at all and the controversy that arose over it bothered him greatly. It felt like he thought that Wiseman was sort of skirting what to him was a very important issue. I have a feeling that it is an important issue, but maybe more important to Rick than to a lot of other people. But it was fun to talk with him about that. And it was just a reminder that, you know, whenever we see a movie, but I think particularly when we see a documentary, we're bringing our own background, we're bringing our own understanding and what's important to us. And, you know, when I think of In Jackson Heights, one of the things I love about that movie is that it really treats working class people with real dignity and sort of embraces what they bring to the American dream. And I know I like that more than a lot of people do just because it really resonates with me. And I think Lex Libris probably resonates with people, at least in part, what their experience with libraries are.
people are making their lists of their favorite movies of the year. And I'm a little surprised to see Get Out by Jordan Peele topping the list. It's a debut film by this guy who's better known as one of the two people in Key and Peele, a comedy group with a show on Comedy Central. But this movie is topping people's lists for a reason. I guess another reason it was sort of a surprise is that it's a horror film, basically.
That's right.
And yet, I have heard that Mr. Peele bristles at the idea of putting labels on what this film is when people have called it a satire or a comedy or horror. He rejects all of these. It's all of those. I found it very funny and it's horrific. But as all good comedy and all good horror does, it has a bite. I think that that is probably what people are latching onto and what makes it seem sort of transcendent or transcendent of the genre or making effective use of the genre. So the idea is it begins with this young woman and man who are heading off to see her parents. And you get the feeling that this is the first time he's meeting her parents. This is a girlfriend and boyfriend. In fact, he asks her somewhat trepidatiously, "Do they know I'm black?" And she's like, "Oh, they don't, but why would that matter? I mean, it doesn't matter." So she's, you know, "Why would that matter?" And he has this, you know.
It might matter.
It might matter. And I feel like that is the kernel of this entire film.
Sure.
The idea that it's very easy for the white person to just not ever notice that there's racism in her family or in her world.
Yep.
And yet it is assumed that it is likely to be a possibility for the African-American.
Yep.
And it just expands from that. What if, in fact, if they were, you know, harvesting black bodies for to be slaves or to be for their parts or their attributes or whatever. And that is where it sort of launches from that point and becomes truly horrific. And I think there is a fair bit of humor not only in that idea that it would be expanded to that possibility, but also just in the small moments that there's sort of humor throughout. But in addition to the humor and the horror, it is very astute at this idea that it's very easy for her, especially in the first half, that she is perhaps naive about the racism that may exist in her family. He's assuming that it will be there, something he has to deal with. And to see that dynamic sort of play out in parallel is really interesting. To see her sort of a little hyper chipper about it and don't worry about it. He's going to want to talk to you about how he voted for Obama, of course, but he's going to want to prove that he's not racist, which is the sort of other form of racism. But it takes off from there. And I'm going to assume that people listening to this will see it before they listen, because it really, the reveals are what it's all about.
Sure.
And we'll just not worry about spoilers.
I think we'll
be the best bet. Yeah. Did you like the movie?
I did. And I like it, particularly the points that you've talked about, in the sense that how it sort of exposes less prominent but yet still insidious aspects of racism, and how those just play out every day for minorities, and especially African Americans in our culture. You know, you mentioned there is that great line, "He's going to want to tell you how he voted for Obama," but those early encounters between Chris, the young man, and the parents are fantastic, because, you know, they're so desperately trying to show how progressive they are, and yet what they really want is his validation. And so, you know, it creates this burden or this responsibility he has to reflect back to them that they're not racist, even though at least in some ways they are, without realizing it. And of course, as we'll find out later, they are much more racist. But I sort of really like those moments, because I think, you know, it's the sort of thing that a lot of people, you know, especially white people, wouldn't necessarily think about, and maybe even guilty of. And so the movie sort of confronts you, like, oh, have you done this with your African-American friends, or, you know, people that come into your life who are minorities? You know, how do you sort of, you know, put the onus on them to reflect back to you the fact that you're a good person? And so I found those moments in the movie, especially in the first half of the movie, both funny but also powerful.
Yeah, I love that kind of thing where there's something off in this social interaction.
Yeah.
But pinpointing what's off is fun for an audience. Like when they're first on their way, before they even get to the family house, they run over they hit a deer on the road and they stop and it's a, you know, police come, they call the police. It turns out they don't really need to. They could have called animal control, he explains. But anyway, the police are there. And he wants to see the license from her boyfriend. He wasn't driving, but and she immediately picks up on this as this is obvious, right? This is an obvious form of racism where the cop needs to investigate the African American, doesn't care about the white woman driving the car. And yet she doesn't see it in her family in these other sort of less obvious ways. It isn't a cop wanting to do a background check on you. It's just, as you said, someone looking for validation or somehow just treating you differently.
Yeah, and it's interesting. If I'm remembering this scene right, I'll admit it's been about 9 months since I saw this movie. But if I remember that scene correctly, Chris just wants to kind of it all to go away, whereas his girlfriend Rose wants to sort of make a big deal about, you know, how the cop has responded. And for him, he knows that's problematic. That can only lead to bad things. And again, that rang true to me.
It did ring true, yeah. Although then when they're finally back on the road and on their way, he says, that was kind of hot. And she's like, well, I'm not going to let anybody, you know, do that. And he's like, you know, you get the sense that, yeah, it's kind of cool the way you stood up for me. I really wish you maybe wouldn't have provoked that. But still, you know, kind of, you know, it's still something that's it's her position on this is still attractive at that point. Yeah. Later, there's a shift, you know, when she needs to choose, you know, her family or him. And it becomes comically horrific. I felt like this was the sort of thing that could have been a Key and Peele sketch, but was blown out into a movie length kind of thing. But sometimes.
So does that work for you then? And does it feel like it's too stretched out?
No, it actually does work for me. And I feel like, you know, when Saturday Night Live has tried to do that, sort of notoriously making a string of bad movies based on a sketch that doesn't really work at feature length.
Yeah.
This is something that's like, yeah, this could have been a sketch, but this is better as a movie because you get to flesh out all these little things, all these little details that are like, you know, he's at her house and it's not just a weekend with her parents. It turns out they're having, they're having friends and family over and it's a whole big weekend. And so there's going to be a party and he's going to be, you know, shown around as, oh, look at the new boyfriend. He spots one of the other guests who's also black and he goes over, hey, it's nice to see someone else, you know, glad about the only one. And that rings true to me as like something that people do gravitate towards people like themselves. And yet the fact that that doesn't play out the way he expects it to is his first key that, you know, well, not his first, but it's like another clue that something here is really off, not just a little off, but really off.
Yeah, that's right. For me, that's a little bit where the movie starts to break down. I like the movie, and I should probably preface this by saying I'm not a big horror movie fan. Apparently, there's lots of kind of in jokes for horror movie people, and there's sort of references to all different kinds of movies here, and I didn't get any of those, and so part of my lack of appreciation for the film might just be a lack of knowledge. When the movie sort of shifts into real horror movie mode, which is maybe in the last third or so, I didn't find that quite as compelling. It seemed like there were too many plot holes for me. And maybe that's not a fair criticism to make of a horror movie. Maybe that's just intrinsic to the genre. But I kind of missed the more subtle social commentary that the movie does in the first two thirds, which didn't seem as prominent to me in the last third, but I'm not sure if that's how it felt to you.
Well, I think it's true that it switches into a bloodbath basically with lots of murders in a very short period of time. But I sort of liked how that is what we expect the genre to do as he sort of battles his way out of this place. And yet there were still interesting observations there. Like, he's going to be killed at a certain point if he doesn't just get out. And to get out, it means, you know, hitting people over the head. It means it means completely incapacitating them. You know, it means taking them out. And so as he does that, there are scenes of him with the adrenaline rushing through him and frothing at the mouth. And you get the sense that, oh no, this is the angry black man that has been so caricatured by culture and art in our country's history. How does this play out? And it does in this final moment when he's sort of taking on the last villain, which is a huge spoiler, but we assume you're past the spoiler point at this point, which is his girlfriend. He's choking her on the road because she's otherwise going to kill him. She had a shotgun. And just as he's doing that, a police car arrives, and you realize how horrible this looks, no matter what we've just seen.
Well, that's true.
We know he's got to battle. He's fighting for his life here. And yet, how is this going to look? And she plays into it. The filmmakers on the screenplay play into it by having her turn, look at the headlights, and say, "Help, help." Mm-hmm. You see the look on his face as he's thinking, I know how this story is going to be told, no matter what I say, no matter what I claim has happened here. And then there's yet another turn when we realize who steps out of the car. It's his friend. It's not it's a TSA airport
police. That's right.
Police.
That's right.
His friend becomes a more prominent actor in the last third. He has been a sort of a friend on the phone up until now, but he's actually taking matters into his own hands. But I loved how I sort of agreed with you that I felt like when it reached that third and it's like, okay, we're just going to play this out with a lot of blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was expecting that to just coast to the end, having set up this premise. But when I saw that it was still working these tropes, I thought, I like this. I don't know that it's, a masterpiece, but
right.
It's so beautifully done that I really like that. And I can't remember the last time that a horror film like this, or if you prefer a satire, was topping people's lists or was like one of people's favorite movies of the year. I mean, that's pretty cool. A use of genre.
Yeah, I agree. And even if I sort of admit that it's not always my cup of tea, it's still a really good film, absolutely worth watching. And what it's doing and sort of bringing ideas of race and culture into a different form of a different venue, I think is particularly interesting. You know, if you imagine that, the sort of audience that's going to go to see this movie is not the same audience that's going to read, Between the World and Me, or is going to read James Baldwin, then I think it's doing some really good things and some good work, and it's a good movie to boot. It's funny, I was, I've actually been reading different books by James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates, his Between the World and Me this year. And so for me, the movie is part of this larger project of thinking about race. I grew up in Flint, Michigan, which is mostly African-American city. And that was true even when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. And I grew up in a almost completely African-American neighborhood. I was, of 5,000 or so people in this housing project. I think there might have been four or five white families, of which mine was one. And so for me, growing up, I always felt like I fit into an African-American world. But I've sort of realized, especially in the last 10 years and this year in particular, is that I didn't really fit in at all. I had sort of enormous advantages that I didn't even realize at the time. When you go to an elementary school where there's 400 or 500 kids and there aren't that many white kids, it's amazing how, what's the word I'm looking for? Lucky the white kids get to be. I mean, they're the ones who the teachers sort of notice and the ones that the teachers kind of highlight and move ahead. And so reading James Baldwin, I also read this book this fall, called Mississippi, by Anthony Walton, who's actually more of a poet than an essayist, but this is a nonfiction book where he wrote it in 1997, but he thinks about his own upbringing. He grew up in suburban Chicago, but both his parents are from Mississippi and sort of escaped to the North in the 50s and 60s. And so he decides to go back to Mississippi and kind of just try to understand what his background is like and what it was like for Southern blacks growing up in the civil rights era and also before. But it's for me, and trying to bring this a little bit back to Get Out, is just it's been an eye-opening year for me just thinking about what it's like to be white in an African-American context, and also sort of just how little I know and how much I sort of need to know. And Get Out fits into that. And so even if I don't sort of embrace it as one of my top 10 movies of the year, which I don't, for me, there are a few too many flaws. It still is a movie that I've thought about a lot this year. And I think there's, in that sense, it's a really rewarding movie.
I reread Baldwin recently too. The Fire Next Time is just one of my, it's one that I go back to and reread. I think about his opening quote in that. I think he wrote it in, it was like the late 60s when people were celebrating, it was 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And
okay.
And he had written this letter to his nephew or something. I forget the details, but he said, I remember this quote was, "You and I both know that this country is celebrating 100 years of freedom, 100 years too soon," you know, yeah. Which feels pretty right. You know, I feel like, you know, our recent climate has revealed how much of that is still with us.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates and the Between the World and Me. One of the major themes is the plunder of black property and black bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you don't have your body as an individual, what do you have? And it turns out that is what the villains in Get Out are after.
Now you're in this sunken place.
Yeah, that's what she calls it. Now, I'll control the motor function, so I'll be...
me. You'll be me.
Good. Good. You got it quick. Good on you.
Why us, huh? Why black people?
Who knows? People want to change. Some people want to be stronger, faster, cooler.
Black is in fashion.
But please don't lump me in with that. You know, I could give a shit what color you are. No. What I want is deeper. I want your eye, man. I want those things you see through.
This is crazy.
Okay, I'm done.
It was great. I feel like I just want to absorb observations about what that life is like, because it's not at all mine. And it's so easy from this point of privilege to not have to care, not have to even notice it.
Yeah.
And that's the joke of Get Out. Mm-hmm. But it's also why it's affecting in its own way.
Yep. Yeah, because it really does in a very concrete way show for an audience all of the things, for a white audience in particular, all of the things that we don't have to worry about, all the things that, you know, just don't even... we don't even notice, but our, you know, just day-to-day life for a minority in our culture. I saw a movie earlier this fall. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a small little kind of essay film called Rat Film. Director Theo Anthony. I've noticed it show up on a few top 10 lists here. It's an interesting film because it's not exactly a documentary, but it's the closest thing about Baltimore. And so it's called Rat Film because one of the main characters is this guy who goes around hunting rats in Baltimore. But that then becomes this sort of larger metaphor for how segregation has worked in Baltimore and how redlining has worked in Baltimore to sort of isolate, or not isolate, but to, you know, sort of restrict African Americans into certain sort of neighborhoods that are obviously not attractive and not worthwhile. I saw this movie around the same time I was also reading this book called The Incredible Life of Henrietta Lacks. And I don't know if you know this story either. It's a nonfiction book about a woman who grew up in, but moved to Baltimore as an adult. And then she died of cervical cancer when she was a young woman, I think around 30. But the reason she's famous is because right as she was dying, doctors took a tissue culture from the cancer, and somehow, because of something particular about her cancer, they were able to actually regrow these cells and grow these cells and grow these cells. And so the HeLa cells, H-E-L-A, short for her name, have become the most important cells in the world. And even now they still grow. And this is what, you know, so many different scientific experiments have been done. But the book is about her family and how her family didn't even realize that this had happened until, you know, decades later. And so it's about how institutional racism works in Baltimore. But it's interesting for me how sometimes you can see a movie and you can see a book and or you can read a book and they overlap in such interesting ways and they sort of capture something at least that I've been thinking about and Get Out works in the same way. I think if you're thinking at all about race and culture and this particular moment in our history and where it's become so conflicted, movies like Get Out, I think, are really important for just broadening our horizons.
Absolutely. And I feel like it's even a little depressing that there are things that are still eye-opening.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, I don't know if you read Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead.
Not yet.
It won the Pulitzer Prize. Oh, it's great. And it's you'd think that this is a topic that's been well covered, slavery and the Underground Railroad and the fight for freedom. And yet it is depicted in a way that's just so different and vibrant than I have seen before. And just it made me think about things about slavery that I had not thought of before. It was a little bit like, well, it's like Middle Passage is Robert Hayden's famous poem about the slave ships that
That's
came.
Right.
And it's a masterful poem, but it embodies the kind of thing that you don't often think of as being in a poem, that it seems like it took years of research that are embedded in this. It's long for a poem, but it's still a poem. You know, it's small compared to even a short story or something, and yet it's just dense with details about what it was like on a ship coming across the Atlantic. And I feel like just reading it opens my eyes about things that I had. It's easy to abstract the idea of slavery into our history and we hear about it, but to see it visualized in a really crystal clear way, like Middle Passage does, or like Underground Railroad does, the Whitehead book, it's like, I feel like, you know, that there's still things we can understand about the horror of it. And even though Get Out is just a horror film and it's just a funny movie, I love that it's based on things that are still present in our culture and our society and that are still fears. And as all good horror movies do, it builds on fears that are true and that are real and that are, you know, extrapolated into something visual for a movie, but they are very real in people's lives. And it's kind of cool that a movie of a genre is able to do that. You mentioned the Mississippi. Was that the name of the book that you read that was more like poetry?
There's poetry in it, but it's mostly both history and memoir. It's more history than Between the World and Me, but there's a lot of memoir too, as he sort of interviews his parents and then he interviews other family members about, you know, why they left Mississippi or why they stayed. But it's funny. That just reminds me what you just said of there's one poem in this book that I particularly like, and it sort of fits in a strange way with Get Out and also with our conversation. It's very short, so if you don't mind, I'll read it. It's called Reconstruction. Free to plant, free to hoe, free to chop every row. Free to harvest, free to pay, free to borrow, free to stay.